Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys to the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory. I'm coming in at the last second. It's been a busy day. The topic really today is money, money, money. And it came from a question that somebody asked that, as soon as I get all my bells and whistles punched here, somebody asked because I had made a comment years ago, and actually I believe it's written in one of the books, that Caesar's loan money into circulation. And people, you know, they're shocked by that idea. They actually think, like, where do you get that distorted idea? Well, how do you think the money of Rome got into circulation to begin with? And did they have a Federal Reserve that was issuing money? Nah, not really. So what was the deal with the Federal Reserve, and how did it operate? And what did we do before there was a Federal Reserve? So the Federal Reserve comes along. These guys, these bankers, decide that they want to have a central bank that all the other banks will depend upon. See, all banks could issue bills of credit. They could issue legal tender. And they did that. You know, a bank note. That's what it's called, a bank note. You actually do something similar when you write a check. You're actually creating money. Because you'll write a check, you'll give it to somebody, they'll give you goods. Now you take those goods, and you have the goods, and he has your check. Where's the money? He's going to actually trade that check at the bank, and they're going to put money in his account or give him cash. And then that bank's going to take the money, that check back to the bank somewhere, and get credit from the bank that check was written on, because your bank may not be the same bank. So you're actually doing something more than just creating bills, you know, banknotes. You're writing checks. But you, for a short period of time there's the money that you had in your account in existence. There's the money, the value that is in your check in existence. And there's the value of the object that was purchased. So there's, for a short period of time, there's like three times the amount of money in circulation than there actually is. So, or at least twice as much, because you've created money. You do the same thing, even more so maybe, when you buy a money order at the post office. You give the post office $100, you buy a money order, and now you use that money order to buy something else. Somebody will accept that money order as if it was money. So there's the money you have that was in the bills, and then the money of the money order. Well, it even gets more complicated than that, because the money that you gave, the $100 that you gave at the post office, isn't real money anyway. It's a note, and it's a Federal Reserve note. And according to the Federal Reserve, it has no value. It's a value in the conscience of the people. The people imagine that it has value, and so that therefore it has value. And so anyway, we talked about this morning on the 2 hours, and you can go back and listen to that. But we talked about Rome, the Republic, and we talked about Rome, the Empire. And we talked about, we gave examples of stock markets. And we quoted Bruce Barton, who had the number one bestseller in 1924. So you probably don't remember that. But in 1924, he wrote a bestseller that's The Man Nobody Knows. And it was actually about Jesus Christ. And Barton argued that Christ, far from being a dreamer, only interested in spiritual affairs, had been the first businessman whose parables were the most powerful advertisement of all time. Christ was, according to Barton, a man who picked up 12 men from the bottom ranks of business, and that might be acceptable. They were the bottom ranks of business. They weren't. They had businesses. They were fairly successful. At least some of them are clearly, fairly successful people. for that time. But they weren't fabulously rich. Although Jesus was fabulously rich. Most people don't know that. Jesus was an extremely rich family. Joseph was wealthy, and Joseph's father or uncle-in-law was extremely wealthy, one of the wealthiest men in the Roman Empire, Joseph of Arimathea, who had mine interests all over. As a matter of fact, he was high-ranking in the Roman government as an overseer of mines throughout the Roman Empire. And mining was a big thing with the Romans, and we talked a little bit about that this morning, about how and how they became so big in mining. Mining gold, mining copper, mining salt, mining almost everything you can think of. Joseph of Arimathea had lead mines, and the lead was used by Romans all over the Roman Empire, including Great Britain. So this is a huge commerce, and we showed a lot of that. And their commerce involved their temples. Their temples were not like we think churches on the street corner. Their temples were actually places of business. And we talked about their temple, the Juno Moneta, which was a very wealthy temple. And what did it do in that temple? What did they do in that temple of Moneta? Well, they minted coins. That's what they did. That's where you get the word money from, moneta, monetary. These are all coming from the word moneta, which is the goddess of moneta. And it's actually two goddesses, to make it short, because the other name's too hard to pronounce, is Juno Moneta. Is actually two gods or goddesses, both owning the same coin. In other words, there are two values in the coin, two interests in the coin that give it value. Now, I talked briefly about that, but I didn't really explain that in this morning's shows, and you have to listen to them all as a series in order to catch this. But I made reference to it, that like a gold coin or a silver coin, there is a value in the gold and silver, just a value to people. You know, it took labor to mine it, smelt it down to get it pure, and you have this value in the gold that has value to people. And that may be different to different people and different at different times, but it has value. It has what they call substance. And substance is very important because it has weight and it is measurable. And the Bible talks about just weights and measures. Well, just weights and measures has to do with the weight of a coin or a disc or a piece of bullion, square, round, whatever shape it is. The weight of it and the purity of it is the just weight and measure. Measure is the amount of pureness. Weight is the actual weight, how much it weighs. What is the substance of that disc? I'm calling it a disc rather than a coin, because when something is coined, there is a value stamped on it. Now, the original dollars were stamped with dollar, which actually comes from a word thaler. But it ended up being a weight of measure. This thaler was a weight of measure. So if it was a thaler of silver or a dollar of silver, that was a certain weight or measure. And its purity, thaler was a mine owner and produced a lot of silver, and therefore produced a lot of thalers, a lot of dollar coins. And they were used for exchange of value, especially when you were trading from one community to another or going over a long distance. You could carry silver, you could carry gold, and it had a certain value, but it wasn't all that heavy as carrying 1,000 pounds of grain. You'll buy grain where you get to, but you could buy a modius of wheat, which is 30 pounds, for a few dimes worth of silver. So a dollar's worth of silver or $30 worth of silver, you could buy more grain than you could carry. So, you know, but you could carry 30 ounces. What is that? Not even 2 pounds. So, and if it was 30 ounces of gold, you could buy more grain than you could eat in years. It would really supply you with commodities, because silver and gold were commodity monies. They were value. Iron was even a commodity money, but it wasn't as valuable as silver and gold. Lead was a commodity money, but it wasn't as valuable. In Sparta, weren't allowed to have gold and silver coins. They had lead coins, and they stamped on them the value of those coins that had nothing to do with the substance of the coins. They just said, this is worth this much, this is worth that much. And people had to accept it because Spartans were Nazis. They were tyrants, and they ruled over most of the people of Sparta. Most of the people in Sparta weren't Spartans. They were slaves to the Spartans, who were a small group of warrior-like people who controlled all the people in the valleys of Sparta. And despite what the movies tell you, they weren't necessarily good folks. They were good warriors, and they were loyal. They had loyalty, but they also oppressed people. We've told stories about how Sparta operated, but that's not the topic of today. Today is the topic of money. So did the Roman emperors loan money into circulation? Well, for one thing, money was around. Even moneta as a temple was around long before the first emperor. And so who was issuing money before that? Well, in the different Greek city-states, they issued money for lots of different reasons. Mostly, give you an example. We briefly mentioned it, but if you go back to the golden calf was a central bank. They took all their gold. Gold was very portable wealth. I mean, silver was portable, but gold was even more portable. Most of the people who dealt in gold were traders from one community to the next. The value of the gold was so much that you could take gold a long way and fill a ship load of trade goods and sell them for a small amount of gold that would leave a lot of space still in your ship because gold was so valuable. You could do this with other things too, but gold was very tradable commodity money. And they dealt in bullion, bronze, brass, all these things. They in sheets of copper, you know, big thick bars of copper that might weigh 30 pounds, 50 pounds. They were bullion, and they were valuable, and they were used to trade for that. When you had the sea kings who were going around trading all the time, every port you pulled into, gold, silver, copper, bronze were all valuable. You could make knives from bronze. You could make things from gold, and they were just it was just considered valuable because it was such a precious metal. So anyway. And so to answer the question about did the emperors issue gold coins or did they loan them into circulation? Well, generally speaking, they loaned them in one way or another into circulation. They did not issue them. These aren't Federal Reserve notes. Now, when they had the golden calf, they had to create some sort of monetary value based on what you deposited in the golden calf, the reserve fund. That's what it was called in the Greek city-states, these golden statues. You were issued by the temple some sort of clay, usually, was the commodity. They didn't do paper. They did clay. They baked it. So it was like a ceramic. It wasn't going to dissolve if you dropped it in water. And so it could get wet and rain, you could fall in the river, and it would still be this clay tablet, this little clay coin. And it had a certain value. If you put in 10 ounces of gold, you would get so many ounces or so many of these clay scarabs. Or they were scarabs in Egypt. I don't know what they called them in Israel, but they were some sort of identifier. They call them tessera in Rome, and they had a value. And you use that as money, but it was only good within your community. It wasn't any good outside of your community. There might be some people who lived nearby that would take some because they could know that they could come and trade them in the local community. But it was a way of creating a closed economy so that people had to trade within the Israelite community. It also was a way in which to secure your loyalty because when you face the enemy, you wouldn't run off across the hills because your money, your gold anyway, was in this golden statue. And if you fled in the face of the enemy, you had to leave your gold behind. So it gave you something to defend. That's your gold. That's your statue. You are part of the commonwealth, and they are forcing you to be loyal, which is why the Spartans outlawed gold and silver coin, why they only had lead coin. They didn't. When the people had the value of their labor in their pockets, this gave them power. This gave them, you know, they could accumulate wealth. That if they had none of that, it made them subject. And so societies learned very early on, and of course this is the message of Moses, put your gold in your purse, in your own purse on your side. Don't put it into common statues. What's going to create the bonds of your society is faith, hope, and charity in that perfect law of liberty, where you care about one another. And we talked about that this morning, where the Roman family would make some sort of deal or help out another family or do something for another family, and they would carve on a stone their family name and the other family name, both on the same stone, and sometimes they would even carve the word hospitality in Latin. And if you had that stone, you could go up and show it to a member of that family, and they would bring you into the house. They would accept you because of the fact that there was these bonds that may have started generations before between your family and that family. And they called that hospitality. And there were lots of ways. They didn't always have a stone. Sometimes they just knew, I'm a son of so-and-so. And they say, oh, well, we know him. You come in. I always tell a story about when I first come out to Summer Lake, that I went into the local restaurant, which was since been torn down, and I actually built a new restaurant there in its place years later. But the guy running it was not much of a restaurateur, to say the least. And we came, they opened up about 10. We wanted to get breakfast, and they really didn't want to wait on us. They didn't know us, and we didn't feel very welcome there because we were out of towners. And but anyway, when we got up to leave after we had a hamburger for breakfast, because they didn't have hardly anything on the menu, we said, how far is it to Summer Lake, which was the town where we were headed to? And my brothers lived there in Summer Lake at the time. And they all looked at each other like, why do you want to know? Because the people who owned the restaurant at that time lived in Summer Lake, even though this was 40 miles to the south. And they wanted to know, and I says, well, my brothers lived there. And I said who my brothers were. And then suddenly, well, they knew my brothers. Now it's old home week, you know. Now they're all over you. All they want to shake your hand, and they meet you, and now you're a friend. You can get the best service in town because they know you. This is the way small communities were. You're a stranger, you're a stranger, you're a stranger. But if you're a relative of somebody they know, you're family. I had the same experience in Dolan, South Dakota. Long hair back in the 60s going through there. And finally we asked where old Doc Williams' office was. Isn't that across the street in that upper deal? Because, I mean, he didn't live there anymore. But half the people, or more than half the people, were probably delivered by old Doc Williams, which was my grandfather. Well, they were so suspicious of us with California plates and long hair back there in the 60s that they didn't know what to think of. Why were we in their town? But as soon as they found out we were the grandsons of Doc Williams, we were like, we could go anywhere. We had keys to the cities. That's called hospitality. That's what communities used to have all the time. People would risk their life to save you because of what your grandfather did for their grandfather generations before. This is how you invest in the kingdom of God, which is a society. Well, I revealed this morning one of the things that most people don't know about the Roman society. I actually revealed a lot of things that most people don't know about Roman society, but one of them is this societas publicana orum, which is actually societas publica, which is not libera res publica, which is where they get the word republic. Republic means free from things public. Societas publicana orum has to do with investing in your society and actually is moving in that direction of a commonwealth, because your investment would purchase you partes of society. You would be a shareholder of society. Well, they quickly carried this over into not just being a shareholder into society, but shareholders into actual corporate creations of society. They created this societatis in order to organize systems and to pay for the building of public structures like the temple at Moneta that would end up coining money, like the temple at Janus, like the temple at Saturn, which is where you registered your birth certificates of your children so that they would have an inheritance in this societatis, so that they would be eligible for the benefits of societatis. And so whoever invested in this was actually loaning money to the rest of the community in a way in which they would build these public forums, these public institutions, these temples. They were loaning their money. They weren't going to get it back at interest, but they would get it back because now they were a partis of that society. They were a part of that society. They were paying members of that society. Now, there was a socialist nature to this, because you might be a small payer, but be taken care of just the same by the social welfare that might be run through that society. They would register the poor man's birth certificate the same as they would register the rich man's birth certificate. And so the poor man would have an entitlement to benefits the same as the rich man would have entitlement to benefits. Well, the more they became a benefit-oriented society, the more they became socialist in nature, which Polybius talks about, the more everybody took a share of what everybody had to pay in. But when they used this system to actually build a building or to build a harbor or to build a road or to build a ship, and I didn't get into that this morning program, but they used to build ships with hundreds of sailors, would carry tens of thousands of pounds of material. I mean, it was like a floating city. They were gigantic. They were like the Ark. They built those ships. There were lots of them built. They've excavated some of them. Some of them ended up at the bottom of the sea eventually, as all ships will. I mean, they were building them out of wood, but they were huge. They took huge amounts of labor to build them. People had to cut the timbers, bring the timbers down the river, put this together, roll it into the sea, then build the decks inside, build the compartments inside, have cranes in order to hoist up things and load them with cargo. And then they would sail these ships across the Mediterranean all the way to places like Egypt, and they would buy grain. They would buy the grain by trading gold and silver and iron and anything you made. You could make stuff for your local community and you get so much money for it. But if you made stuff and put it on board these gigantic ships, they would go and they would get stuff that was worth more. They would trade for stuff worth more and you would get more back. So it was great for the economies and it made Rome rich. But it took agreements, much like the societatis publicana orum, because these were a lot of times private enterprises, but they knew how to do all this stuff. That societatis partes, which we call shares, it's a lot like city bonds that you would create in order to pay for whatever it is, whatever public service you wanted to provide. But these were loans, because when it was a partes, you would expect a return. And in sometimes when these were corporate systems, they would actually expect shares back. And I gave the example of when they went up to Spain and mined away a whole mountain of gold and brought back that gold. Everybody who participated got shares. You got shares because you worked on the project for 2 years. You come up as this, you know, maybe you're an engineer or a surveyor, and you're going to get so many shares for so many months or years of service. If you're a laborer, you get so many shares. If you're part of the guards that went up, which would be the centurions, you'd get shares in the profit besides your regular wages. They didn't always start out with wages. Sometimes it was just shares only and, you know, room and board while you go up. But somebody back there in Rome was also putting up money to pay for grain, to buy other equipment, to buy supplies, to, and of course you had to have people going back and forth with mail service and resupplying them because they're going to be there for several years. And then some people will bring you back the gold. And of course, you'll have to bring soldiers with them to make sure they're not robbed. And so all these guys are playing their part. It's an extremely complex venture involving hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people over years of time. And people sitting back in Rome who put up money to do this, they want to get their shares. So they have to have absolute careful accounting of all the gold that comes, all the money that's spent. And this is what they were doing. Well, that same complex economy was also when Caesar, and I pointed out that Caesar in 44 AD became legal to put a living person's face on the coin. Earlier than that, the coins in Rome anyway, they weren't like the golden statues of Greece and Athens, and people were coining and they were actually coining money so that they could operate in commerce. And in some places, like in Sparta, they were coining lead money that had no value, and they were still using it in commerce, but it was only good within Sparta, wasn't much good anywhere else because it had no intrinsic value. It only had its stamped coin value. And so the only ones who would have accepted that is other people who lived in Sparta. Most people who did not live in Sparta would not accept that. It's no value here. So anyway, so this is the complexity. And then I didn't get to this morning, I was going to mention Gresham's Law. And Gresham's Law is simple. It's where legal tender laws exist, bad money drives out good money. Well, what's bad money? Money that really doesn't have any value. Federal Reserve notes are legal tender. They have no real value. They only have an imagined value. And they will drive out of circulation gold. Well, how do they drive that out? Nobody wants gold because we have legal tender? No, nobody wants to spend gold. Nobody wants to spend silver because it has real value. While legal tender, there may be plenty of legal tender. Well, today, something peculiar has happened. Most people don't think gold has any value. They're shocked to even feel a gold coin or a silver coin. And so most people don't think gold has value, yet gold, what is it, an ounce or $1,500 an ounce, you know, and silver's, you know, it goes up and down. But that has to do with the mind of people and their willingness to accept the paper dollar. When the paper dollar disappears, and this has happened in many countries where the value just plummets and suddenly, you know, it takes a wheelbarrow load of money to buy a loaf of bread, is because that money, they lost confidence in it. The consciousness of the community no longer had any faith in it. So what is this all about? Well, yeah, they loan money into circulation. The emperors loaned this money. And I gave the example, even when they sent troops to defend a particular community, they did this in order to get paid back. When they sent those troops, they built harbors so their ships could come in. They built docks so their ships could come in. They built roads that would take supplies from the harbors inland where they could sell it. They built marketplaces. They built coliseums. They built all kinds of things, always with the intention of getting a return. So you can call it a loan. You can call it an investment. When people buy stock in the stock market, they're investing in the stock market. They're giving money. If they buy the stock directly from the company, and we gave SpaceX and the unicorn type billionaire investment programs, if they buy shares directly from the company gets that money, and they can use that money as capital venture to go to Mars or go to the moon or go into space or put satellites up and make new innovations and new inventions. And so they're literally that when they buy the stock, they're investing in that company. And that company takes the money and is supposedly will now invest it and make more money and make that stock worth more. There's a secondary thing that takes place, and that is speculation, where people see the stock going up, not because the company's more valuable, but just the stock by itself is going up. Then people invest in, they want to buy that stock because they see the value going up. Well, this is those two separate goddesses of Mnemosyne. I said the word as close as I could, and Moneta. And so we just refer to it as Juno Moneta. And they both have an interest, and you can call it numismatic interest if you're dealing with coins that are actually have a intrinsic value, and then the value that other people put on it. And this is, of course, what they're doing when the Caesar put his face in 44 AD and living people started putting their face on coins. They own that coin. That's their gold. They owned it. They would spend it or loan it into circulation on investments into civic projects, into building roads, into building docks, into whatever, expecting a return. How did that return come? You want to use the dock. You have to pay for the use of the dock, either in bullion or in the coin with your picture on it. Okay, now what's going to take place when you do that, when you set up a system like that? And this is why Caesar did this. He was a clever, clever businessman. But we're not going to tell you why right now. We'll tell you when we come back to Keys of the Kingdom after a brief break. Okay, so welcome back. So why would they do this? And they're stamping a value on a coin. They're stamping a face on the coin. And the value of the coin, like an aurus, if it's gold coin, one aurus weighs so much. I mean, you take like, you know, take a pound of gold and you can make 42 aurus coins with a 1 pound of gold. That would be like 7.96 grams per coin. If you had a pound of silver, you could make 84 denarii with a pound of silver. So that's how heavy a denarii would be. So it'd be like 3.9 grams. It's a little lighter, a little smaller. Like I would think it would be about a dime. Now, some of this varied over a period of time. And Augustus actually standardized a lot of things, but then other guys started shifting that standards away from what Augustus had standardized to. So sometimes when we use some of these figures, we're dealing with a particular point in time. But so you had a pound of gold in the form of 42 ari and ari coins, and you stamped on them a face value and the face of a living person like Augustus Caesar. Now you open up a harbor, and the harbor says, you know, you want to dock your boat there, your ship there, and you're going to make a fortune off all the goods you brought, but you got to dock there. You're going to have to pay for docking space. And they're going to tell you how much that's worth. And that value of that docking space is going to be monetized in those ari coins. So if you need 42 ari coins, you could go get a pound of gold and give it to them, but that's not what they're asking for. They're asking for 42 ari coins. That's how you pay. If you want to pay in trade or other bullion, they're going to jack the price up. If you want to go to a money changer, and there were money changers everywhere, it wasn't just in the temple. You want to go to a money changer and you say, well, look, I got some gold. I need to pay my docking fees here at the harbor, which are 42 ari. So can I give you a pound of gold for 42 ari? And they'll say, no. You got to give me a pound and a quarter worth of gold, and I'll give you 42 ari. He says, well, wait a minute, 42 ari is only a pound of gold. That was too bad. You need the 42 ari. So that's what it's going to cost you, because we're short on ari today. So it could cost you 2 pounds of gold to buy 42 ari. So what it does is it makes the ari more valuable than the actual face amount of gold. And there's a premium on it. And so you have to spend sometimes extra money to get Augustus's coins. So it drives the economy to want those coins, and people make more money. It's not as much gold, but it's actually worth more than the actual amount of gold that's in it. And of course, we do that now with collector's items all the time. But this is why there's this two interests, these two goddesses of the Temple of Moneta. And like I said, there were other things going on in the Temple of Moneta. They were coining money. They coined money in the Temple at Ephesus. And Ephesus was built by 127 different countries who actually invested in the Societatis. It was literally the World Bank of its day. And they were investing in it, not only building it, but also funding it, because it invested money in some of these enterprises, shipping enterprises and everything else. And so everybody was doing everything to make money. They weren't just doing it for fun. They were doing it to make money, to get wealthy, to get richer and richer, to end up with more ari in your pocket than sesterites and dupondies, which are other forms of money, or 400, an aris, one coin, was literally, this is one standard at one time, was worth 25 denarii. And 100 sesterces was worth one ari. And 200 dupondi were worth that. And just to give you an idea, and like a dupondi is a bronze or copper coin. And a sesterce, sesterces, depending on what case you're dealing with, was a metal alloy also. But a denarii was specifically silver, and an aris, ari, were gold. And so you had these exchange rates that were official exchange rates. But the fact is, if you had a lot of gold in an area, the gold might lose its value, because people aren't going to bid so high to get their 42 ari, because there's lots of ari around. But if there was a shortage of ari and you had to have that to pay your landing fees at a dock, you're going to want more. So it was a way of manipulating the economy. And this is how people rose to power. They manipulated the price of grain, and they rose to power because grain was a commodity money as well. And they made people dependent upon these things. So anyway, all that, and the money changers making money off of the needs of other people was not part of a system of just weights and measures. It was a part of a system of speculation, manipulation, controlling prices, etc. And it was eventually leading to a shambles of economies, devastating the economy from time to time, and especially when they demonetized. Well, I shouldn't say demonetized, but they began to meddle with the metal. They began to decrease the amount of silver in the Roman silver denarii, and eventually till there was no silver in the denarii at all. And that price of a modius of wheat went from 6 denarii, 6 dimes, for 30 pounds of wheat, to 120,000 denarii. But it wasn't silver denarii anymore. It was iron denarii. or clay denarii. They actually used clay coins at times, and tessera. And none of that is taking you towards the kingdom. All that's taking you away. It's barring your way from it. It's all disintegrating because it's all about wealth and obtaining wealth. Now, you remember I said that Jesus was wealthy, came from a wealthy family. Jesus said, it says actually in the New Testament, that though he was rich, he made himself poor. And there was a reason why he made himself poor. There were rules in Judea, in Israel, way back dating to the days of Moses, that the Levites had no inheritance in the land. They had access to the altar. They could eat of the altar, but they had no inheritance in the land. Levites owned land, but they owned it all in common, which is why you see in the New Testament the church owning all its land in common. Why you see immediately when they're talking about that, they talk about a Levite named Hoses, who becomes Barnabas, sells his land, lays the money at the foot of the apostles. Why? Because Levites were not to own land as a personal estate, the substance of the land. They held all Levite land in common. One Levite sell you land, another Levite can come and redeem it at any time because he doesn't have a lawful title. He only has a legal title. And that's another whole subject in itself. You have to look up our shows on legal title and our articles on legal title. Legal title does not include the beneficial interest. The beneficial interest of the property of the Levites was held by God. The beneficial interest of the Levites themselves, the labor of the Levites, belonged to God. So whatever they did, when you gave to a Levite, you gave to God. And there was a reason for this, because they were creating a society that would not bring you into the bondage of Cain, would not bring you into the bondage of Nimrod, would not bring you into the bondage of Egypt, nor the bondage of Rome. As a matter of fact, the system that Christ was setting up would set you free from those systems. And so who, real quick here, I mean, we've only got about a little less than 15 minutes left of the show. Who makes coins for the government of God? Well, in the government of God, you can use anybody's coins. You can use anybody's trade goods. You can use anybody's money. But if you there wasn't anybody else and you wanted commodity money like gold coins, silver coins, copper coins, who would do it? There's a guy who we've written about, we've done shows about, who thinks that money is evil. You must get rid of all money, including all commodity money. It's ridiculous. It's the love of money that is evil. Where money is more important to you than your neighbor, where benefits are more important to you than your neighbor or your neighbor's children or your neighbor's grandchildren, that is the root of all evil. But money itself is just a commodity. You know, you could give me 10 silver coins and I could go and smelt them and make a frying pan with them. I actually have made a little thimble for oils, for doing aromatic oils that's made out of silver. Took a silver coin and I pounded it out until it was a little bowl. And I put the oils in that when I go to put oil on people. Because you put it in that silver coin and, you know, that's a pretty pure vessel in which to put it. And so I can dip my fingers in that and rub them on when people need anointing or blessing. But I also made a bell out of a silver coin once. So you can make things out of it. It has value. It has substance. There's not much you can use paper dollars for when they have no value. During the Civil War, they used it for the toilet. That's what they used the Confederate script for. It wasn't good for anything else. It wasn't very good for that, but it's better than the Sears and Roebuck catalog, I guess. But the reality is, who would make the money in God's kingdom? Well, gold miners and goldsmiths would make the money. They wouldn't create banks or deposit because you're supposed to deposit it in your house, in your pocket, in your own purse. But they could make it and, you know, they could mine the gold and just take the gold over to somebody else who specializes in smelting the gold and he makes the coin and he will make a little bit on his labor. and the miner will make a little bit on his labor, and the storekeeper will make money on his labor, and everybody is working hard to produce a value to everybody else, because the goldsmith made the coin more standardized, and he would be disciplined to make it more standardized. If he did a good job and purified it properly, and he got a reputation for purifying it properly and making them uniform, people would want his coins. But the only thing he's going to stamp on it, is his mark and the just weight and measure. 999 fine silver. 1 ounce. That's a just weight and measure. He's not going to say it's worth so many gold coins or so many of these silver coins are worth so many gold coins, because that's going to vary. Because it's a commodity. You know, when the wheat harvest comes in, wheat's not worth that much because everybody's got wheat. But when the bins run out, then the wheat may be worth more than its weight in gold because of the fact that it's in short supply. And so that's the market. Now, in the kingdom of God, what are we investing in? Are we investing in gold? Are we investing in silver? Are we investing in copper? Are we investing in SpaceX, you know, the billion-dollar unicorn investment companies that surround it? No, what are we investing? We're investing in one another. Our investment is not for profit, but for love. Now, we do cast our bread upon the waters in hopes that they come back to us, but we only have hope. We don't have a contract. We actually care about it. We are creating a human value, a value of the heart, by helping take care of one another. Somebody was calling me last night from the Midwest and evidently wanted some sort of help. I was trying to get her pinned down to say exactly what she wanted, and she just didn't quite do it. But we have other people in other parts of the country asking for help. Well, we've explained now all this week. We did a show on it. It wasn't a show. It was actually a course. We have a live study course. And if you join the network, which everybody should join the network, we have a live study course on Tuesday nights. And people can ask questions. And our study course this last week was on the congregations of, for, and by the people. And we pointed out, according to Mark 6:38, that Jesus commanded that his apostles make the people sit down in companies, which are companies are usually about 10 people, small groups of companies, sit down in companies upon companies, in rank upon ranks, according to hundreds and fifties, or fifties and hundreds. And because there were 5,000 people there, your fifties and hundreds will also become thousands. So tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. Just like Jethro, just like Moses did, actually like Abraham had done, and like people have done even before the time of Nimrod. But they were free assemblies. They sat down and they organized themselves in this network, and then he fed them loaves and fishes. People want to know why the network isn't bigger. Well, because people are still making excuses as to why they can't join those companies, those congregations. They're making excuses why, and they can't quite see how this works. But if you use your imagination a little bit and think a little bit, you got 12 apostles, they're going to feed 5,000 people. How in the heck are they going to feed 5,000 people, 12 apostles? How are they going to distribute this stuff? I mean, they're going to be doing this till the cows come home. But if they have the network, if they're sitting down in the tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands, every group can send up somebody to make sure that every group is represented, and we know who's going to get what, and we're going to be able to distribute what is received equally for everybody. And nobody's going to be left out. It's not going to be a mob. You know, back when they had the hurricane in Louisiana, And I saw people trying to get organized. Some people actually did start doing it. But if they understood the tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands, they could have not only redistributed the food that they had available so that it got to everybody, they could have protected the people who had to use restrooms and were being molested and being, and they could have driven out the enemy because they would have been organized. But they don't know how to do this anymore. It was common knowledge back then. That's why you don't hear them talking about it over and over again, trying to explain it like we do. But it was common knowledge that this is what you had to do in a free society. You had to organize yourselves in a network. But people think religion is what they think about God. They don't want to actually feed one another. Oh, there's people who, when they need their power bill paid or they need medical bills paid, oh, they're going to cry out for help. Or they want some place to go and live for nothing. They're going to cry out for help. But they're not going to get anything because they won't sit down in the tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. They're not going to get any loaves and fishes. They're not going to get taken care of. They're not going to be a part of Israel. They're not going to be a part of the place where God prevails because they won't gather together. They think, oh, I just think a thought and I am saved and God will save me. Now, I understand that a lot of you out there have good hearts. But what a good heart and a dollar bill will get you a cup of coffee. I don't know, maybe it's $2 now for a cup of coffee. It's getting more and more expensive. You need to put that good heart into the action following the commands of Christ. And Christ commanded. That's what it says. When he's asking how many loaves and fishes do they have, and et cetera, and they tell. It says in verse 39, and he commanded them to make all sit down by companies and companies upon the green grass, and they sat down in ranks upon ranks by hundreds and fifties. And then he fed them. And that, of course, is what they did at Pentecost. That's what they do at the Feast of Tabernacles. That is how they do it. This is probably close to a Pentecost, you know, during Christ's ministry, because it was evidently in the spring, because it talks about green grass. So, this is how it's done. And you invest in one another, and you get to know one another. So what you want to do is, you know, obviously we're not going to have 10 families on the block where you live. So the church is not going to be a convenient place you can go down to a building. We don't build buildings anyway. You're the stones of the building of God. You're the bricks and mortar of the building of God, of the temple of God. And until you build that temple of God with living stones and bricks by coming together. So what you want to do is, okay, you find a minister you like. You need to find one that's near you, as near as possible. He's not going to come to your house necessarily. You don't have to go to his house. This is an individual walk. But you're going to want one that's near you, because if everybody does that, wants a minister who's near them, then you're going to be near the other people in your congregation, in your assembly. And so that if they need help, you will be nearby to provide that help. The Bible tells you, Christ tells you, that you are to love one another. Love your neighbor. Those are the people nearby. Yeah, and love. And that love should magnify itself through that network of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. But you need to gather with the people as locally as possible. That's why we created the network. And when you gather with them as locally as possible, you can actually see them. Then as you bring more people to the network, you can break off your congregations. If you have 20 people in your congregation or 20 families, you break it off into two congregations, still linked together through the network of ministers, through the 50s and 100s. But now you can help each other, and now you will find yourself drawing closer and closer and closer physically, where you can help people more and more and more. And that is seeking the kingdom. And when you invest like that, God will run out and meet you halfway and help you and bless you and kill the fatted calf. And unless you do that, I don't know what I can do for you. But we'll have to close now. Until next week, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.